The squad set off along the canal again, following the gentle curve northward. Etihad's plan was to stay on the side path until they reached its junction with the Outer Circle Canal, then turn back into Jeevan's. He sent his G-Eagle swooping low over the roof and towers of the district, guiding it toward Bolton Street. It was a damp grey morning, with the last of the night's rain clouds still clotting the sky as they slid slowly westward. Every surface was slick with rain. However, the indomitable citizens of Macathran were out in force as usual, thronging the streets and narrow alleyways. Etihad's G-Eagle flashed silently above them, ignored by most. Then he caught a movement that was out of kilter. Halfway along Sonral Street, someone in a hooded jacket turned away from the eagle and adjusted his hood, pulling it fully over his head. It could have been nothing. The G-Eagle was still over 50 yards away, and it was damp, the air chilly. It was perfectly legitimate for someone to pull his hood up in such circumstances. A lot of people in the same zigzagging street were sporting hats that morning. The man wasn't even alone in wearing a hooded jacket. "It's wrong, though. I know it." "Wait," he told the squad. He swept the street with his farsight, searching for the one suspicious figure. The man's mind was shielded, though the tinge of uncertainty seeped out. Again, perfectly legitimate. He could be worrying about anything from a bad quarrel with his wife to debts. Etihad observed the direction he was taking, and ordered the G-Eagle around in a long curve. It settled on the eaves of a three-story house at the end of Sonral Street, out of sight of its target. As he waited, Etihad realized the man in the hooded jacket was not alone. He was walking with two others. Then the G-Eagle caught sight of him on the street as he came around one of the shallow turns. By then the hood had slipped back slightly. "Oh yes, lady, thank you," Etihad said.
"What's happening?"
Dinlay demanded.
"He's back," Etihad growled.
"The thief from the Silver Market, the one who was holding the box."
"Where?"
Kansin demanded.
"Sonral Street, top third."
The squad registered annoyance.
"We can't far-sight that far," Boyd complained.
"Okay, here you go." Etihad gifted them the G-Eagle's sight.
"Are you sure?"
Maxon said.
"He's right," Kansin said.
"It's him, the bastard. I can just far-sight him."
"There are two others with him," Etihad told them, "and he's nervous about the G-Eagle, so they're not here for anything legitimate. Let's spread out and surround them. Keep a street between yourself and them the whole time. I'll track them with farsight. I don't want to risk him seeing the G-Eagle again. That'll scare them off." They all smiled at one another, edgy with nerves and excitement.
"Go!"
Maxon cried. After 5 minutes of steady jogging, Etihad wished he had paid more attention to keeping fit. As before, Macathran's citizens were reluctant to give ground to anyone in a hurry, least of all a red-faced, sweating, panting young constable. He dodged and shoved and wiggled his way along streets and through alleys, glaring at anyone who voiced a complaint. His uniform made it worse, with its hot, heavy fabric restricting his movements. Eventually he got into position, a street to the west of the trio. His farsight showed him his squad mates taking up positions all around them.
"Got them,"
Dinlay's long talk announced as he slowed to a walk.
"Me too," Boyd reported.
"What do you think they're here to steal?"
Maxon asked.
"Small enough to carry easily, valuable enough to be worth the risk,"
Dinlay replied. "Another one been paying attention during our lectures, but unfortunately that covers about 90% of the shops around here."
"Could be something in one of the storerooms, too," Boyd suggested.
"Or a house,"
Kansin added. "Let's just keep watch on them," Etihad told them. "When they go into a building, we close in. Remember to wait until the crime has been committed before arresting them."
"Hey, never thought of that,"
Maxon said. Etihad let his farsight sweep through the buildings around the trio, trying to guess what they might be interested in. Hopeless task. The suspects turned off Sonral Street into an alley so narrow that one person could barely fit. Etihad hesitated. They were heading towards his street, but it was a blind alley, blocked by a house wall 20 feet high. His farsight probed, revealing a series of underground storerooms beneath one of the jewellery shops on Sonral Street.
There was a passage leading up to a thick metal door in the alley. "At least they're consistent," he remarked. "That's a jeweler's shop on top."
"On top of what?" Boyd asked.
"There's some kind of passage leading off the alley," Cancine told him. "It leads downward somewhere, Edyard. Can you actually sense what's there?"
"A little bit," he admitted reluctantly. "Just some kind of open chamber, I think."
For a moment he wished everyone had his ability. Life would be a lot easier.
"So now what do we do?" Maxon said.
"We can't rush them. Not down that alley."
"Wait at the end,"
Dinley said.
"They can hardly escape."
Edyard's farsight was showing him a whole network of interconnecting passages and rooms running under the row of shops. The passages all had locked doors, but once the thieves were inside, there was a chance they could elude his squad within the little underground maze. "The rest of you, get into Sonral Street," he ordered. "I'm going around the back to see if I can find another way down there."
"You're going in alone?"
Cancine asked.
"Edyard, there's three of them, and we know they carry blades."
"I'm just going to make sure they don't have an escape route, that's all.
Come on, move."
He was faintly aware of his squadmates hurrying to the broad street beyond the alley. One of the thieves had bent down beside the small door, doing something to the first of its five locks. From what he could sense of the locks, Edyard knew he would not like to try to pick them open. He concentrated hard, pushing his farsight through the city's fabric to map the buried labyrinth of rooms and passages. In truth, there were only three exits in addition to the one the trio currently was trying to break through. Below that level, though, Edyard sensed the web of fissures that wove the city structures together. Several twisted their way up past the storerooms, branching into smaller clefts that laced the walls of the buildings above. He tracked back, finding a convoluted route that led to the street in which he was standing. His third hand reached out, probing the fabric of the wall at the back of a tapering alcove between two shops. Nothing. It was as solid as granite.
"Please," his long talk whispered to the mind of the slumbering city, "let me in."
Something intangible stirred beneath him. A flock of rougals took flight from the roofs above. "Here." His mind pressed into the rear of the alcove. Something pushed back. Colourful shapes rose into his thoughts, swelling much faster than the birds overhead. In his dazed state, he thought they resembled numbers and mathematical symbols, but much larger and more complex than any of the arithmetic Akim had taught him. With these equations, the universe surely could be explained. They danced like sprites, rearranging themselves into a new order before twirling away. Edyard gasped, struggling to stand up as his legs shook weakly. His heart was pounding far harder than it had been from his earlier run through the streets. He felt the structure of the wall change. When he peered forward, it looked exactly the same as before, a dark purple surface with flecks of grey stretching all the way up to where the curving roofs intersected three stories above him. But it gave when his third hand touched it. There were people on the street around him, strolling along. Edyard waited until a relatively clear moment and stepped into the little alcove. Nobody could see him now. His hand touched the section of wall at the back and slipped right through. The skin on his finger tingled, as if he were immersing them in fine sand. He walked into the wall. It was a sensation his brain interpreted as a wave of dry water washing across him. Then he was inside. He opened his eyes to complete darkness. His farsight cast around and showed him that he was suspended in a vertical tube. Even without visual sight, Edyard instinctively looked down. Farsight confirmed that his feet were standing on nothing.
"Oh, lady."
He started to descend. It was as though a very powerful third hand were lowering him gently to the bottom of the fissure that snaked away horizontally under the buildings. Yet he was convinced it wasn't a telekinetic hold. He could not sense anything like that. Some other force was manipulating him. Oddly, his stomach felt as though he were plummeting, even though he was moving relatively slowly. His feet touched the ground. That was when whatever force had gripped him withdrew, leaving him free to sink into a crouch. When he touched the wall of the fissure, he felt a slick of water coating it. A rivulet was trickling over the toe of his boots. He could hear it gurgling softly.
"It's a drain," he said out loud.
astonished that anything so fantastical could exist to serve such a mundane purpose. Despite perfectly clear farsight, he patted around with his hands. The drain fissure was slightly too small for him to walk along it upright. Its side walls were about 5 feet apart. He took a breath, none too happy at the claustrophobic feeling niggling at the back of his mind, and started to move forward in a stoop. The thieves had gotten through the locked door at the top of the passage, an impressive feat in such a short space of time. Two of them were descending the curving stairs to the door that sealed off the bottom, while the third stood guard outside. Ediard moved faster, navigating several forks along the drain fissure. He observed the thieves manipulate the locks on the second door and go through. Then he was directly underneath the storeroom they were ransacking. The layout was distinct. The wooden racks laid out in parallel. Small boxes were piled on the shelves. A large iron box stood in one corner with a very complicated locking mechanism. They were ignoring that. Ediard looked up as his farsight pervaded the city's substance above him, a solid mass of rock-like material 5 yards thick. He concentrated, closed his eyes, stupid, but well, and applied his mind. Again the equations rose from nowhere to pirouette breezily around his thoughts. He began to rise, slipping through the once solid substance, like some piece of cork bobbing to the surface of the sea. Once again his stomach was convinced he was falling to a degree that brought on a lot of queasiness. He had almost reached the floor when he realized the thieves would sense him the second he popped up. Quickly, he threw a concealment around himself. Then he was emerging into the storeroom with a weak orange light shining all around. The floor hardened beneath his boots. "What was that?" a voice asked. Ediard was standing behind the rack at the back of the storeroom, out of direct sight. He held his breath. "Nothing. Fucking stop panicking, will you? There are only two doors, and the other one is locked. Now help me find the crap we came here for before someone senses us down here." Ediard slowly walked around the end of the rack. He could see the pair of them moving along a rack, taking boxes off the shelf and prizing them open with some kind of tool. A quick look inside, and the box would be tossed aside. Most of them seemed to contain little boxes. Dozens of them were clinking as they rolled about on the floor. "Here we go," the one in the hooded jacket announced. He just forced open a box full of tiny packets. One was opened to reveal a coil of metal thread. Ediard wasn't sure in the storeroom's low orange light, but it might be gold. "I'll check out the rest," the other one said. The one with the hooded jacket began stuffing the packets into an inside pocket. Ediard dropped his concealment. "What the fuck?" Both thieves swung around to face him. "Hello again," Ediard said. "Remember me?" "Ediard!" Cancine's panicky long talk reverberated in his skull. "Sweet lady, where have you been? We've been going frantic. How did you get in there?" "It's the little shit from the market," the thief in the hooded jacket spit. "I fucking knew that G-Eagle was on the prowl." He reached inside his jacket and pulled out a long blade. At the same time, his third hand tried to push into Ediard's chest for a heart squeeze. Ediard laughed as he deflected the attack. Then his third hand slipped out and crushed the blade the thief was holding. The metal rippled, then warped into a slim, bent spike. Ediard twisted the tip into a U-shape. "You're under arrest for the theft and attempted assault on a constable."
"Fuck!"
the other one yelled as he raced for the door. "One coming out," Ediard's long talk told his squad mates.
"Are you all right?"
Dinlay demanded. Never better. He had not taken his eyes off the hooded thief. The man held up the ruined knife and gave it an admiring grin.
"Tough guy, eh? Are you smart along with it? There's enough precious metal in here to make everyone happy."
"You want attempted bribery added to the charges?"
"Idiot."
The thief turned his back on Ediard and walked casually toward the doorway out to the passage. "Stop right there," Ediard ordered. The thief's third hand lifted one of the small bottles into the air behind him. Ediard frowned uncertainly. Another bottle rose, accelerating to crash into the first. Glass shattered. A fireball spewed out, dazzling white in the gloomy storeroom. Ediard twisted away instinctively, his shield hardening. Flaming globules spattered against it.
"Ediard!"
the squad long talked in unison. "I'm all right." He was blinking his eyes furiously, trying to get rid of the long purple glare blotches. An acrid smell was growing strong. Yet his farsight revealed just a few flickers of flame on the racks closest to the fireball. His third hand swatted them, snuffing the flames before they posed any danger. Then he noticed the black holes in the boxes scattered across the floor, as if flames had burned through them very quickly. The raw edges still were smouldering. When he looked closer, he saw they were coated in some kind of tar that was bubbling away. He shook his head in bewilderment.
"Got them!" Maxon announced victoriously. "Lady, that last one's an arrogant bastard. You sure you're okay, Adyard?"
"Yeah, I'm fine." He started to walk out of the storeroom. Some deep instinct made him tread carefully around the patches of hot liquid glistening on the floor. Thin wisps of vapor were layering the air close to the ceiling, producing a stench that made his eyes water. When he passed the bulky metal door, he trod on some of the packets containing metal thread. The thief had thrown them all away. Ediard picked one up, frowning. Why did he do that? Mystified, he hurried up the passage and out into the alley, where his squad was waiting with the subdued prisoners. Now that he had time to think about what he had done and what the squad had achieved, his elation was rising with the potency of a dawn sun.
The court was convened in Macathran's Parliament House, which dominated the Majate district. Technically, it was one building, but its component structures had amalgamated into a village of huge halls, assembly rooms, auditoriums, and offices, with cloisters instead of streets. Right at the center was the elaborate democracy chamber, where the Grand Council met to debate policy and laws. Wrapped protectively around that were tiers of offices for the Guild of Clerks, which worked to administer the city's regulations and collect taxes. A whole wing contained well-appointed offices for all the district representatives, where they could be lobbied by their constituents about every perceived and actual injustice. Somewhere inside, underground, it was rumored, were the treasury vaults, containing mountains of gold and silver, where the coins were minted. The chief constable also was based in one of the five conical towers, along with a modest staff. For centuries, the outermost tower, closest to the city gate, used to house the militia barracks, but they had long departed, the serving soldiers to several barracks within the city, while the general and senior officers had taken up residence in the Orchard Palace next door. The vacated barracks had been taken over eagerly by the ever-expanding Lawyers Guild. Although it was democratically open to anyone, it was the interconnecting domes that ran alongside the Centre Circle Canal with which the average Macathran citizen was most likely to be familiar. They housed the courts of justice, as well as the constabulary's main holding cells. Ediard and the rest of the squad had been shown around by Master Solorin, who had explained the history of every corridor and room at inordinate and boring length. Part of their training was to attend trials, so they could accustom themselves to the procedures and listen to the verbal sparring of the lawyers. Ediard had been looking forward to that part, but in all the trials they had watched, the lawyers had confined themselves to simple questions to those in the witness stand. There had been an obscure argument about interpreting a precedent established 400 years earlier to settle a dispute between two fishmongers and their supplier about who got priority on the catch based on the length of the contract. Ediard barely understood the words they used, let alone followed the logic involved. The only criminal trial they'd seen had been one in which the constables had arrested a bunch of minor family sons during an altercation in a theatre late one night. The young men had all been sheepish, never challenged the senior squad sergeant's account, pleaded guilty to all charges, and accepted the fine without question. As far as preparation and experience went, Ediard was beginning to realize how useless it had all been. Two middle court judges and a mayor's council judge had been appointed to preside over the case against the trio of thieves they had arrested. They sat together behind a raised wooden podium that ran along the back of the oval courtroom, clad in flowing scarlet and black robes, with fur-lined hoods hanging over their right shoulders. The mayor's council also wore a golden chain, signifying his high status. Arrayed in the dock on their left, the thieves stood with two court constables in dress uniform standing guard. They finally had given their names. Arminel was what the hooded leader called himself. He was no more than 40, with a drawn pale face and thick sandy hair that he wore long to cover large ears. At no time did he look worried. If anything, his expression indicated ennui. His accomplices were Omasis and Hari. Hari, still in his teens, was the one they had told to stand guard in the alley. He'd been charged only with complicity to steal. Aminel and Omasis both were charged with theft and aggravated trespass, while Aminel had to face the additional charge of assaulting a constable. The jewelry shop owner had swiftly identified the contents of the two bottles Aminel had smashed together as a highly volatile spirit-based cleaning fluid and acid. Ediard had shivered at the thought of what could have happened if his shield had not been strong enough to ward off the fireball. He had wanted Aminel to be charged with the attack on Kavine in the Silverham Market, but Master Vospol, the lawyer Captain Ronark had retained to prosecute the case, had said no. It was too long ago for witnesses to be considered reliable. "But I recognized him immediately," Ediard had cried. "You saw someone behaving suspiciously," Master Vospol had said. "You believed him to be the participant in the previous crime."
"Kavine will identify him."
"Kavine was stabbed, quite badly. The defense will argue that that makes him unreliable. Let's just go with these charges, shall we?" Ediard had sighed and shook his head. It really should have served a warning about the methodology of Macathran's legal affairs. Instead, the first inkling that their case was not as watertight as they imagined came when the defendants all entered a plea of not guilty.
"They can't be serious,"
Ediard hissed, as Master Cherix, the defense lawyer, stood before the judges and entered the plea. The squad was sitting along the rear wall, all in their dress uniforms, waiting to be called by the prosecution. Captain Ronark sat on one side of them, with Sergeant Che on the other. Almost all of the seats were empty. Ediard didn't know if he was pleased about that. He wanted the city's citizens to see that his squad had helped bring a small part of their troubles to justice, show them that the law had not deserted them. Master Cherix raised a surprised eyebrow at Ediard's exclamation and turned to look at the squad. Master Vospol shot them a furious look. "Be silent," his long talk ordered. It was, Master Cherix explained, a terrible misunderstanding. His clients were honest citizens going about their business when they perceived the blast in the alley. It had blown open a small door, and full of concern for human life, they had ventured into a storeroom filled with smoke and flames, at great personal risk, to make sure there were no injured people inside. At that point, the constable had stumbled upon them and received a totally false impression. One by one, the three accused took the stand and swore under oath that they had been acting selflessly. As they did so, their unshielded minds radiated sincerity, along with a modicum of injured innocence that their good deed had been misinterpreted. Master Cherix shook his head in sympathy. Woe begone that the constables had acted so wrongly. "A sign of the times," he told the judges. "These constables are well-meaning young folk, rushed through their training by a city desperate to reach staffing targets for the sake of politics, but in truth, they were far out of their depth on that sad day. They, too, need to make arrests to prove themselves to their notoriously harsh station captain. In such circumstances, it is only understandable why they chose to interpret events in the way they did." Ediard met Arminel's stare. "He tried to kill me, and his lawyer's making out it was all a misunderstanding. That we're in the wrong. It was so outrageous he almost laughed." Then Arminel's expression twitched just for an instant. The condescending sneer burned itself into Ediard's memory. He knew then that this was not the end. Nowhere near. After 2 hours of listening to the defendants, Ediard finally was called to the stand. "About time. I can soon set this straight." "Constable Ediard," Cherix smiled warmly. He was nothing like Master Solorin, but a young man dressed like the son of a trading family. "You're not from the city, are you? What's that got to do with this?" Master Cherix put on a pained expression and turned to the judges. "My lords, answer the questions directly," the mayor's counsel instructed. "Sir," Ediard reddened. "No, I was born in the Rulan province."
"And you've been here for what?
Half a year?"
"A little over that, yes."
"So it would be fair to say that you're not entirely familiar with the city."
"I know my way around." I was thinking more in terms of the way our citizens behave. So why don't you tell me what you believe happened?
Ediard launched into his rehearsed explanation. How Armanel tried to avoid the G-Eagle, the squad tracking them along Sunrail Street, arranging themselves in an encircling formation while standing back and observing through Farsight, sensing Armanel picking the locks. At which point we closed in, and I witnessed the accused stealing gold wire from the storeroom.
I'm curious about this aspect, Master Cherrick said. You told your squad to wait in Sunrail Street by the entrance to the alley, yet you went down into the storeroom. But I thought you said Harry had been left on guard duty in the alley. How did you get past him?
I was lucky. I found another entrance through the shop, which backed onto the jeweller's. Master Cherrix nodded in admiration.
So it was hardly a secure storeroom, then, if you could just walk in.
It was difficult, Ediard admitted, praying to the lady to help him rein in his guilt. But this was not a lie, just a slight rearrangement of his true route into the storeroom. I just managed to get there in time.
In time for what?
To see Armanel stealing the gold wire. He was doing that before he flung flaming acid at me.
Indeed. I'd like you to clarify another point, Constable. When you emerged after this alleged event to join up with your squad, did Armanel have any of this supposed gold wire on him?
Well, no. He dumped it when I challenged him.
I see. And your squad mates can confirm that, can they?
They know, yes.
Yes, what, Constable? We caught them doing it. I saw him.
By your own statement, you were deep underground in the poorly illuminated storeroom at the time of the alleged theft. Which of your squad mates can farsight through 15 yards of solid city fabric?
Cansine. She knew I was there.
Thank you, Constable.
Defense would like to call Constable Cansine.
Cansine passed Ediard on her way to the stand. They both had meticulously blank expressions, but he could tell how worried she was. When he sat down next to Dinley, the others all smiled sympathetically.
Good job, Che whispered,
but Ediard was not convinced.
You have a farsight almost as good as your squad leaders,
Master Cherrix asked.
We came out about equal in our tests.
So you could sense what went on in the storeroom from your position in Sunrail Street?
Yes.
Ediard winced. She sounded so uncertain.
How much gold wire was in there?
I'm not sure.
An ounce? A ton?
A few boxes.
Constable Cansine,
Master Cherrick smiled winningly.
Was that a guess?
Not enough gold to be obvious to a casual farsight sweep. I'll let that go for the moment.
Constable Ediard claims you perceived him in there.
I did,
she replied confidently.
I sensed him appear in the back. We'd been worried when we lost track of him.
You sensed his mind. There's a big difference between a radiant source of thoughts and inert material, is there not?
Yes, of course.
Master Cherrix patted the jacket he wore under his black robe.
In one pocket I have a length of gold wire. In another pocket I have an equal length of steel wire. Which is which, Constable?
Ediard concentrated his far sight on the lawyer. Sure enough, there was some kind of dense line of matter in each pocket, but there was no way to tell the nature of either one. Cansine looked straight ahead.
I don't know.
You don't know? Yet there is only 5 feet of clear air between us. So can you really say with certainty you perceived my client picking up gold wire when he was on the other side of 15 yards of solid mass?
No.
Thank you, Constable. No more questions.
It came down to an argument between two lawyers. Ediard found himself grinding his teeth as it was presented as his word against Armanel's.
Acting suspiciously, Master Vosbol ticked off on his fingers. Gaining entry to a storeroom behind two locked doors. Seen by a constable of impeccable character stealing gold wire, attacking that same constable. My lords, the evidence is overwhelming. They came to the storeroom with the express intent of theft, a theft which was valiantly thwarted by these fine constables at great personal danger to themselves.
Circumstantial evidence only, Master Cherrix pronounced.
Facts twisted by the prosecution to support a speculated sequence of events. A country boy alone in an underground city storeroom full of smoke and flame. Confused by the strange environment and regrettably unreliable, his claims unsupported by his own squadmates and friends. My clients do not deny being in the storeroom,
responding to the fire as any responsible citizen would. The prosecution has offered no proof whatsoever that they ever touched the gold wire. I would draw my lord's attention to the precedent of Macathran versus Laney. Hearsay is inadmissible.
Objection, Master Vospol barked. This is testimony by a city official, not hearsay.
Unsubstantiated testimony, Master Cherix countered, must be accepted as having equal weight to my client's account of events.
The judges deliberated for 8 minutes.
Insufficient evidence, the mayor's counsel announced. Case dismissed. He banged his gavel on the bench.
Ediard's head dropped into his hands. He absolutely could not believe what he'd just heard.
Lady, no, he gasped.
The defendants were cheering, slapping each other jubilantly. Ediard was disgusted to see Masters Vosbol and Cherix shake hands.
It happens, Captain Ronark said gravely. You did a perfect job. Nobody could do better. I'm proud of you. But this is the way it is in Macathran these days.
Thank you, sir.
Dinlay and Maxon murmured sullenly. Ronark flashed them all an anxious expression, debating with himself whether he should say more. This will be useful to you, he said. I can imagine what you think of it right now. But next time you'll know what to do, how to be extra careful in gathering evidence, and we'll nail that little bastard good and proper. He nodded at Che and walked down to talk with Master Vospol.
Buy all a drink, Che said. I know how bad this hurts, believe me. I've had smart-ass lawyers get scum off on worse charges than this.
A double of something illegally strong, Maxon said. The others nodded in grudging agreement. They looked at Ediard.
Sure, he said.
Arminel saluted him with 2 fingers to his forehead. His smile was gloating. Ediard quashed his impulse to dive across the court and smash his fist into the man's face. Instead, he winked back.
Be seeing you, he whispered.
Chapter 7. The Unisphere had never been a homogeneous system, nor was it designed in accordance with logical principles. That was quite ironic, considering the purely digital medium it dealt with. Instead, it had grown and expanded in irregular spurts to accommodate the commercial and civil demands placed on it by a proliferating interstellar civilization. By definition, the Unisphere was nothing more than the interface protocols between all the planetary cyberspheres, and they were incredibly diverse. Almost every hardware technology the human race had developed was still in operation across the greater Commonwealth worlds, from old-fashioned macro arrays running restricted intelligence, RI programs, to semi-organic cubes, quantum wire blocks, smart neural webs, and photonic crystals, all the way up to ANA, which technically was just another routing junction. The interstellar linkages were equally varied, with the central Commonwealth worlds still using their original zero-width wormholes, whereas the external worlds used a combination of zero-width and hyperspace modulation. Transdimensional channels were becoming more common, especially among the latest generation of external worlds. Starships also were able to link in, provided that they were in range of a star system's space watch network. The massive gulf between technologies and capacities within the Unisphere meant that the management software had swollen over the centuries to accommodate every new advance and application. With effectively infinite storage capacity, the upgrades, adapters, retrocryptors, and interpreters had accumulated like binary onion layers around each node. They had the ability to communicate with every other chunk of hardware to come online since the end of the 21st century, but with such a complex procedure dealing with every interface, the problem of security increased proportionally. It was relatively easy for a specialist E-head to incorporate siphoning and eco-clone routines quietly amid centuries' worth of augmentation files. The problem was one that all the users got around by using their own encryption. However, to decrypt a secure message, the receiver had to be in possession of the appropriate key. Ultra-secure keys never were sent via the Unisphere. They were exchanged physically in advance, a common method for financial transactions. A less secure method was for a user's U-shadow to dispatch a key by using one route and then call on another. Given the phenomenal number of randomly designated routes available within the Unisphere, most of the people who even considered it regarded that as sufficient.
It would, after all, require a colossal amount of computing power to monitor every route established to a specific address code for a key and then follow up by intercepting the message. Of course, that assumption had been made in the early centuries, prior to ANA. For any individual downloaded into ANA, access to that quantity of processing capacity was an everyday occurrence. The Advancer faction routinely ran a scan of all messages to ANA governance to check if any of its own activities had been noticed and reported. When the faction's monitor routine detected a Starship TD connection established to Wolan's Space Watch network, downloading a key fragment to ANA Governance's security division, an alert was flagged. Over the next 2.3 seconds, the remaining 7 key fragments arrived via routes from 7 different planets, and the monitor acknowledged that someone was trying to establish a very secure link. There was nothing too out of the ordinary in that. It was the security division after all. However, all 8 planets were within 25 light-years of the Advancer faction's secret manufacturing station. That bumped the alert up to grade 1. 3 seconds later, Ilanthe's elevated mentality was observing the secure call itself, placed through the 9th planet, Loznica, which was 17 light-years from the station.
"Yes, Troblum," ANA Governance asked. "I need to see someone. Someone special."
"I will be happy to facilitate any request in relation to Commonwealth security. Could you please be more specific?"
"I work for the Advancer faction. Make that worked. I have information, very important information concerning their activities."
"I will be happy to receive your data."
"No, I don't trust you. Not anymore. Parts of you are bad. I don't know how far the contamination has spread."
"I can assure you that ANA governance retains its integrity both in structural essence and morally."
"Like you'd say different. I can't even be sure if I'm talking to ANA governance."
"Skepticism is healthy, providing it does not escalate into paranoia. So, given you don't trust me, what can I do for you?"
"I'm entitled to be paranoid after what I've seen."
"What have you seen?"
"Not you. I'll tell Paula Mayo. She's the only person left that I trust. Route this call to her."
"I will ask if she will be willing to listen to you."
15 seconds later, Paula Mayo came online.
"What do you want?" she asked.
"There's something you need to know. Something you'll understand."
"Then tell me."
"I need to be certain it's you. Where are you?"
"In space."
"Can you get to Sholapur?"
"Why would I want to?"
"I'll tell you everything I know about their plans for fusion, all the hardware they've built, all the people involved. All that, if you'll just listen to me. You have to listen. You're the only person left who'll deal with it."
"With what?"
"Come to Sholapur."
"Very well. I can be there in 5 days.
"Don't stealth your starship. I'll contact you." The connection ended.
As ANA and its abilities were to the Unisphere, so there were hierarchical levels within ANA, discrete levels of ability surreptitiously established by a few of the humans who had founded ANA, abilities only they could utilize. They could not corrupt ANA governance or use the Navy warships for their own ends. That magnitude of intervention would be easily detectable. But there was a back door into several of ANA's communication sections, allowing them to watch the Watchers without the kind of effort the Advancers had to make to get the same intelligence. And as they had gotten there first, they also had observed the Advancers and other factions spread their monitors into the Unisphere nodes as their campaigns and reach grew. They knew which messages the Advancer intercepted.
"Ilanthe is going to go apeshit over that kind of betrayal," Gore said.
"At least we know Troblum is still alive," Nelson replied.
"Yeah, for the next 5 seconds.
"Until he gets to Sholapur, at the very least. And never underestimate Paula."
"I don't. If anyone can collect him in one piece, she can."
"So we might just be able to sit back and relax, if Paula does bring back information on what the Advancers are up to.
Hardware," Troblum said. "That has to be the planet-shifting FTL engine."
"Maybe so," Gore said, but he was offering that as a bribe to make sure Paula listened to something else. Something big and scary enough to get him really worried. Now what the fuck could that be?
Marius sprinted down the corridor. It was not something the universe got to see very often. With his higher field functions reinforcing his body, the speed was phenomenal. Malmetal doors had to roll aside very quickly,
or face complete disintegration. His dark toga suit flapped about in the slipstream, for once ruining the eerie gliding effect he always portrayed. Marius did not care about appearance right now. He was furious. Ilanthe's brief call had been very unsettling. He'd never failed her before. The implications were terrible, as she had managed to explain in remarkably few words. He only wished he had time to make Troblum suffer for his crime. He streaked through the three-way junction that put him in Sector 7B5. Some idiot technician was walking down the middle of the corridor, going back to her suite after a long shift. Marius charged past her, clipping her arm, which broke instantly from the impact. She was spun around, slamming into the wall. She screamed as she crumpled to the floor. The door to Troblum's suite was dead ahead, locked, as of 2 minutes ago, with Marius's own 9-level certificate to prevent the little shit from leaving. The suite's internal sensors showed Troblum sitting at a table, slurping his way disgustingly through a late-night snack. Marius began to slow as his U-shadow unlocked the door. It expanded as he arrived, and he coasted through. Troblum's head lifted, crumbs of a burger dropping from the corner of his mouth. Despite bulging cheeks, he still managed a startled expression. A disruptor pulse slammed into him, producing a ghost-green phosphorescent flare in the suite's air. Marius followed it up immediately with a jelly gun shot. He would obliterate the memory cell in a few seconds. That would leave just Troblum's secure store back on Arevalo. Instead of disintegrating into a collapsing globule of gore, Troblum simply popped like a soap bubble. A rivulet of metal dust spewed out from the wall behind the table where the jelly gun shot had hit. Marius froze in shock, his field scan functions sweeping the room. It had not been Troblum. No biological matter was in the room. His eyes found a half-melted electronic module on the seat, ruined by the disruptor blast. A solido projector. Marius was perfectly still as he stared at it. "What happened?" Neskia asked, as she strode into the suite. Her long neck curved so that her head could see around Marius. "It would appear Troblum isn't quite the fat fool I'd taken him for. We'll find him. It won't take long. This station isn't that big." Marius whipped around, the wide irises in his green eyes narrowing to minute, intimidating slits. "Where's his ship?" he demanded. "Sitting in the airlock," she replied calmly. "Nobody enters or leaves without my authorization." "It better be," Marius spit. "Every centimeter of this station is covered by some sensor or other. We'll find him." Marius's U-shadow ordered the smart core to show him the airlock. The Melanie's Redemption was sitting passively at the center of the large white chamber. Visually it was there. The airlock radar produced a return from the hull. The umbilical management programs reported a steady drain of housekeeping power through the cables plugged into its base. He queried the ship's smart core. There was no response. Marius and Neskia stared at each other. "Shit!" 4 minutes later, they walked into the airlock. Marius glowered at the long, cone-shaped ship with its stupid, curving tail fins. His field scan swept out. It was an illusion produced by a small module on the airlock floor. He smashed a disruptor pulse into the solido projector, and the starship image shivered, shrinking down to a beautiful, naked young girl with blonde hair that hung halfway down her back. "Oh, Howard," she moaned sensually, running her hands up her body. "Do that again." Marius let out an incoherent cry and shot the projector again. It burst into smoldering fragments, and the girl vanished.
"How in Ozzy's name did he do that?"
Neskia asked. There was a hint of admiration in her voice.
"He must have flown right past the defense cruisers as well. They never even saw him."
Marius took a moment to compose himself. Troblum helped design and build the defense cruisers. Either he infiltrated their smart cores back then, or he knows a method of circumventing their sensor systems.
He compromised the station smart core too. It should never have let Melanie's Redemption out.
"Indeed," Marius said. "You will find the corruption and purge it. This operation must not suffer any further compromise."
"It was not me who compromised this station," she said with equal chill. "You brought him here.
You had 20 years to discover the bugs he planted. That you failed is unforgivable.
Don't try to play the blame game with me. This is your foul-up, and I will make that very clear to Ilanthi.
Marius turned on a heel and walked back to the airlock chamber's entrance. His dark toga suit adjusted itself around him, once more giving off a narrow black shimmer that concealed his feet. He glided with serpentine poise down the corridor toward the airlock chamber that contained his own starship. His U-shadow opened a secure link to the cat's ship.
"It's so nice to be popular again," she said.
"We have a problem. I want you to find Troblum. Eliminate that shit from this universe. In fact, I want him erased from all of history."
"That sounds personal, Marius, dear. Always a bad thing.
Messes with your judgment. He's heading for Sholapur. In 5 days' time, he will meet with an ANA representative there and explain what we have been doing. His ship has some kind of advanced stealth ability we didn't know about."
"Gave you the slip, huh?
I'm sure you'll be more capable of rectifying our mistake."
"What do you want me to do about Aaron? He's still down on the planet's surface.
Is there any sign of Inigo?"
"Darling, the sensors can barely make out continents. I've no idea what's going on down there."
"Do as you see fit."
"I thought this was all critical to your plans."
"If Troblum exposes us to ANA, there will be no plans. There probably won't be an advancer faction anymore.
The strong always survive. That's evolution.
Paula Mayo is the representative ANA is sending to collect Troblum."
"Oh, Marius, you're too kind to me. Really."
It should have been tempting. He was alone in a small starship with three amazingly fit men who probably would have been honored to go to bed with him. Oscar had been delighted when Tomancio had introduced his team. Leatris MacPeel was his lieutenant, a lot quieter than Tomancio, with a broad mouth that could flash a smile that was wickedly attractive. He would handle the technical aspects of the mission, Tomancio had said, including their armaments. Gazing at the pile of big cases on the regrav sled that followed Leatris about, Oscar had his first moment of doubt. He did not want to resort to violence, though he was realistic enough to know that it wasn't his decision. Cheriton McConnor had been brought in to help because of his experience with the Gaia field. There was nothing about confluence nest operations that he didn't know, Tomancio had claimed. Oscar was slightly surprised by Cheriton's characteristics. They were almost higher. He had altered his ears to simple circle craters. His nose was wide and flat, and his eyes were sparkling purple globes like multifaceted insect lenses. His bald skull had two low ridges reaching back from his eyebrows over his cranium to merge together at the nape of his neck.
"Multi-macrocellular enrichment," he explained, "and a hell of a lot of customized Gaia motes."
To prove it, he spun out a vision of some concert. For a moment, Oscar was transported to a natural amphitheater, lost in a sea of people under a wild, starry sky. On the stage far away, a pianist performed by himself, his soulful tune making Oscar sway in sympathy.
"Wow."
Oscar blinked, taking half a step back as the vision cleared. He'd almost been about to sing along. The song was familiar somehow, just not quite right.
"I composed it in your honor," Cheriton said. "I remember you told Wilson Keim you liked old movies."
Now Oscar remembered.
"That's right.
Somewhere over the rainbow, yeah?" He took care to reduce his Gaiamote's reception level. Cheriton had produced a very strong emission. It made Oscar wonder if the Gaia field actually could be used in a harmful way.
"Yes."
The last member of the team was Beckia McCratz, whose Gaia field giveaway made it very clear that she would like to bed him. She was equal to Anja in the beauty stakes, minus all the neurotic hang-ups. Oscar wasn't interested, not even on that first morning when he had stumbled out of his tiny sleep cabin to find all four of them in the main lounge, stripped to the waist and performing some strenuous Ni Teng exercise. They moved in perfect synchronization, arms and legs rising gracefully to stick out in odd directions, limbs flexing, eyes closed, breathing deeply. From their Gaia field emanations, their minds seemed to be hibernating. Aliens teleported into human bodies, carefully examining what they could do. It was all very different from Oscar's wake-up routine, which normally involved a lot of coffee and accessing the most trashy Unisphere gossip shows he could find.
That was the whole non-attraction problem. All that devotion to perfection and strength did not seem to leave them much time to be actually human. It was a big turn-off. So we crept around the edge of the lounge to the culinary unit, snagged a large cup of coffee and a plate of buttered croissants, and sat quietly in a corner munching away as he watched the strange slow-motion ballet. They came to rest position and took one last breath in unison before opening their eyes and smiling. "Good morning, Oscar," Tomancio said. Oscar slurped down some more coffee. That morning routine also included no conversation until his third cup. The culinary unit was suddenly busy churning out plates with large portions of bacon and eggs with toast. "Something wrong?" Leatrice asked. Oscar realized he was staring at the man as he ate. "Sorry, I assumed you'd all be vegetarians." They all exchanged an amused glance. "Why?" "When we were flying the Carbon Goose across halfway, I remember the cat kicking up a big fuss about the onboard food. She refused to eat anything produced and processed on a Big 15 planet." His companion's amusement evaporated. To Oscar it was as though he had been transformed into some kind of guru, steeped in wisdom. "You did talk to her, then?" Becky asked. "Not much. It was almost as if she was bored with us. And I still don't know why you idolize her the way you do." "We're realistic about her," Cheriton said. "But she accomplished so much. She killed a lot of people." "As did you, Oscar," Tomancio chided. "Not deliberately. Not for enjoyment. The whole Starflyer War happened because humanity was weak. Our strength had been sapped away by centuries of liberalism. Not anymore. The external worlds have the self-belief to strike out for themselves against the central worlds. That's thanks to Faraway's leadership by example, and the Knight's Guardian are the political force behind Faraway. Politicians don't ignore strength anymore. It is celebrated on hundreds of worlds in a myriad of forms." That was the trouble with history, Oscar thought. Once the distance had grown long enough, any event could be seen favorably. The true horror faded with time, and ignorance replaced it. "I lived through those times. The Commonwealth was strong enough to prevail. Without the strength we showed then, you wouldn't be alive today to complain about us and debate what might have been." "We don't want to offend you, Oscar." Oscar downed the last of his coffee and told the culinary unit to produce more. "So sensibilities aren't a weakness, then?" Leatrice laughed. "No, respect and civility are high points of civilization, as much as personal independence and kindness. Strength comes in many guises, including laying down your life to give the human race a chance to survive. If the Knight's Guardian have one regret, it is that your name is not as famous and revered as the others from your era." "Holy crap," Oscar muttered, and collected his coffee. He knew his face was red. "My era." "All right," he said as he sank back onto the chair that the lounge extruded for him. "I can see we're going to have fun times debating history and politics for the rest of the mission. In the meantime, we do have a very clear objective. My plan is quite a simple one, and I'd like some input from you as we shake it down into something workable. You guys are the experts in this field and this era. So for what it's worth, there are several ANA factions extremely keen to find this poor old second dreamer, not to mention Living Dream, which has a very clear-cut agenda for him. Between them, they have colossal resources which we can't hope to equal. So what I propose is that we jump on their bandwagon and let them do the hard work. We should position ourselves to snatch him as soon as they locate him."
"I like it," Tomancio said. "The simpler it is, the better."
"Which just leaves us with mere details," Oscar said. "Everyone seems to think the second dreamer is on Vyosha. We'll be there in another 7 hours."
"Impressive flight time," Cheriton said dryly. "I've never been in an ultra-drive ship before."
Oscar ignored the jibe. Tomancio had never asked who was employing Oscar, but the ship was a huge giveaway.
"Tomancio, how do we go about infiltrating the Living Dream operation there?"
"Direct insertion. We'll hack their smart core's personnel files and assign Cheriton to the search operation. He's savvy enough to pass as a dream master, right?"
"No problem," Cheriton said. He sighed. "Reprofiling for me, then."
He ran a hand along one of his skull ridges. "I'll make you look almost human,"
Beccia assured him. Cheriton blew her a kiss. Living Dream has been altering confluence nests all across the general commonwealth to try and get a fix on his location, he said. It must be costing them a fortune, which is a good indicator of how desperate they are. It's not a terribly accurate method, but once they narrow it down to a single nest, they'll know the district, at least.
How does that help? Beccia said. A nest's Gaia field can cover a big area. If it's in a city, it can include millions.
If it were me, I'd surround the area with specialist nests and dream masters and try and triangulate the dream's origin. So we can be in the general area just like them, Oscar said. Then it's all a matter of speed.
The factions will be running similar snatch operations, Demancio said. We'll be up against their agents as well as Living Dream.
Oscar picked up on how enthused the Knights Guardian were by that prospect. The faction agents will have bionic weapon enrichments, won't they?
I hope so, Demancio said.
You can match that? Oscar asked nervously.
Only one way to find out.
It was a gentle valley carpeted by long, dark grass that rippled in giant waves as the breeze from the mountains gusted down. There was a house nestled in a shallow dip in the ground, a lovely old place whose walls were all crumbling stone quarried out of the nearby hills. An overhanging thatch roof gave it a delightful unity with nature. Its interior was a technology completely at odds with its outward appearance, with replicators providing him with any physical requirement. T-sphere interstices provided his family with an interesting internal topology and any extra space they might want. He stood facing it, holding his bamboo staff vertically in front of him, torso bare to the air and legs clad in simple black cotton diruku pants. He was shutting down bionic field functions. Attuning his perception to sight, sound, and sensation alone, feeling his surroundings. Nesting cobra, the foundation of self. He moved into sharp eagle and then twisted fast, assuming jumping cheetah, a breath. Opponent moving behind. Bring the bamboo down and sweep, the tiger's claw. Spin jump as a coiled dragon, one arm bent into Spartan shield. Lunge, striking angel. Drop the staff and pull both curving daggers from their sheaths. Bend at the knees into woken phoenix. A vibration in the air. Heavy feet crushing tender stalks of grass. He raised his head to see a line of black armored figures marching toward him. Long flames billowed from vents in their helmets as they roared their battle call. His breathing quickened as he tightened his grip on the daggers. The smell of charred meat rolled across the grassland. Aaron gagged on the terrible stench. Coughing violently, he sat up on the couch in the ground crawler's cabin. Shit, he sputtered, then coughed again, fighting for breath and doubling up. Exovision medical displays showed him his bionics, assuming command of his lungs and airway, overriding his body's struggling autonomic functions. He wheezed down a long breath and shook his head as the artificial organelles stabilized him. Coraline was gazing at him from her couch on the other side of the cabin. She had drawn her knees up under her chin and had a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. For some reason, she made him feel guilty. What? He snapped, all caffeine-deprived bad temper.
I don't know, she said. Those warriors represent being trapped, I think. But they came to you outside your home. You were unable to escape what you are, what you had grown into.
Oh, give me a break, he growled, and tried to swing his feet off the couch. His blanket was wrapped around his legs. He pulled it off in an angry jerk.
Coraline responded with a hurt scowl.
They could also be a representation of paranoia, she said with brittle dignity.
Fuck off, he told the culinary unit to brew some herbal tea, to purge the soul.
Look, he said with a sigh, someone has seriously screwed with my brain. I'm bound to have nightmares. Just leave it, okay?
Doesn't that bother you?
I am what I am, and I like it.
But you don't know who you are.
I told you, drop this.
He settled into one of the two forward seats and stared out of the thick windscreen slit. The ground crawler was lumbering forward, rocking about as if they were riding an ocean swell. Outside, the weather had not changed for the whole trip. A thin drizzle of ice particles, blown along at high speed. High overhead, the dark underbelly of the cloud blanket seethed relentlessly, flickering with sheer lightning.
They were traversing a drab landscape where flood streams had gouged out deep, sharp gullies. Broad headlight beams slithered over the dunes of filthy snow that migrated across the permafrost. Occasionally, the surface of iron-hard soil was distended by some ruins or stumps. Otherwise, there was nothing to break the monotony. Coriolan climbed off the couch without a word and went back to the little washroom compartment at the rear of the oblong cabin. She managed to slam the worn aluminum door. Aaron rubbed his face, dismayed by how he had handled the situation. Something in his dreams was eating away at his composure. He hated to think that she was right, that his subconscious somehow had squirreled away a few precious, true memories. The personality he had now was simple and straightforward, uncluttered by extraneous attachments or sentimentality. He didn't want to lose that. Not ever. By way of apology, he started entering a whole load of instructions into the culinary unit. 30 minutes later, when Coriolan emerged, her breakfast was waiting for her on a small table. She pouted at it. "The crawler's net reckons we're about 90 minutes from the camp," he said. "I thought you'd want to fortify yourself before we reach them." Coriolan was silent for a moment, then nodded in acknowledgement at the peace offering and sat at the table. "Has anyone been in contact?" "From the camp? No. They'd talked to someone called Ericilla the previous night, telling her their estimated arrival time. She had seemed interested, though she had laughed at the idea of any of her colleagues being an abandoned lover. 'If you knew any of my teammates, you'd know you're wasting your time. Romantic, they're not.' We're still connected to the beacon network," Aaron said, sipping another herbal tea. "Nobody is owning up yet." "What do we do if he's not there?" Aaron resisted the impulse to look her up and down again. When she came out of the washroom, she changed into a pair of black trousers and a light green sweater with a V-neck. Her hair was washed and springy. No cosmetic scales were on her face, but her complexion glowed. Clearly, she was ready for her chance to reignite some of the old passion, should he be there. She had kept her guillemots closed fairly tight since leaving Kajani, but the occasional lapse had allowed Aaron to sense a lot of anticipation fermenting in her mind. "I'm not sure," he admitted. "Time isn't in our favor." "And if he is there? What if he doesn't want to be hauled back to Alezzelin?" Just for an instant, something stirred Aaron's mind. Certainty. He did know what was going to happen afterward. The knowledge was all there waiting for him, ready for the moment. "I'll just tell him what I have to do. After that, it'll be up to him." Coriolan gave him a mildly doubtful stare before tucking into her first bacon sandwich. Camp, Aaron decided, was a rather grand description for the place where the team working in the Olhava province had set themselves up. A couple of ground crawlers were parked next to each other in the lee of some rugged foothills. Malmetal shelters had expanded out of their rear sections to provide the team with larger accommodation. But that was all. Aaron parked a few meters away, and they pulled on their bulky surface suits. Once his bubble helmet had sealed, Aaron went into the tiny airlock and waited for the outside door to slide aside. He was hit immediately by the wind. Ice fragments swirled around him. He walked carefully down the ramp, holding the handrail tight. The wind was squally, but he could stand upright. There were enhancer systems built into the suit for when the storms really hit. The suit's main purpose was to protect him from the radiation. Although there wasn't too much physical effort involved, he wished he had nudged their ground crawler closer to those of the team. It took nearly 3 minutes to cover the small gap and clamber into a decontamination airlock on the side of one of the shelters. Coriolan was grunting and cursing her way along behind him. Ericilla, a short woman with a fringe of brown hair flecked with grey, was waiting for them in the closet-sized suit room. She smirked as Coriolan wriggled out of her surface suit, licking her lips in merriment. "No man is worth this," she announced. "He is," Coriolan assured her. Aaron already had extended his field scan function, probing the whole camp. He had detected 4 people, including Ericilla. None of them was higher. Ericilla beckoned. "Come and meet the boys." Viltar and Cytus were waiting for them, standing in the middle of the shelter's cluttered lounge like an army of 2 on detention parade. Nerina, Viltar's husband, gave Coriolan a wary look. "Oh, shit," Coriolan said despondently.
Nerina poked Viltar in the chest.
Well, that lets you off.
The two men relaxed, grinning sheepishly. Aaron sensed the tension drain away. Suddenly everyone was smiling and happy to see them.
I thought there were five in your team, Aaron said.
Earl is down in the dig, Aracilla said. The sensor bots picked up a promising signal last night. He said that was more important than, well...
The way she left it hanging told them she was on Earl's side.
I'd like to see him, please,
Corilyn said.
Why not?
Aracilla said.
You've come this far.
It was another trip outside. The entrance to the dig was on the other side of the shelters, a simple metal cube housing a small fusion generator and several power cells. An angled force field protected it from Hanko's venomous elements. There was a decontamination airlock to keep the radioactive air out so that the team's equipment could work without suffering contamination and degradation. Big filter units filled the rest of the entrance cube, maintaining the clean atmosphere. The temperature inside was still cold enough to keep the permafrost frozen. Aaron and Corilyn kept their helmets on. Excavation bots had dug a passage down at 45 degrees, hacking crude steps into the rocky ground. Thick blue air hoses were strung along the roof, clustered around a half-meter extraction tube that buzzed as it propelled grains of frozen mud along to be dumped on a pile half a kilometer away. Polyphoto strips hanging off the cables cast a slightly greenish glow. Aaron trod carefully as they went down. The solid ground around him blocked any detailed field scan. The bottom of the crude stairs must have been 7 meters below ground level. Aracilla explained that they'd cut into a lake bed that had filled with sediment during the post-attack monsoons. There were several people from the surrounding area who had never made it to Anagasca. The passage opened out into a chamber 10 meters wide and 3 high, supported by force fields. Discarded arm-length bots were strewn over the floor with power cables snaking around them. A couple of hologram projectors filled it with a pervasive, sparky monochrome light. Ice crystals glinted in the sediment contained behind the force field. There was an opening on the far side. Aaron's field scan showed him another cavern with a great deal of electronic activity inside. Someone was in there. Someone who could shield his body from the scan.
Holy Aussie, Aaron breathed.
Corilyn gave him a curious look and strode into the second chamber. It was larger than the first. A third of its wall surface was covered with excavator bots that looked like a mass of giant maggots slowly wriggling their way forward into the gelid sediment. A huge lacework of tiny pipes emerging from their tails led back to the start of the extraction tube. Silver sensor discs floated through the air, bobbing about to take readings. Silhouetted by the retinue of cybernetic activity was a lone figure wearing a dark green surface suit. Corilyn took a couple of hesitant steps forward. The man turned, lifting off his bubble helmet. His face had a Latin shading rather than Inigo's Northern European pallor, and the hair was dark brown rather than ginger. But apart from that, the features had not been altered much. Aaron thought it a particularly inferior disguise, as if he were wearing makeup and a bad wig.
Inigo,
Corilyn whispered.
Of all the restoration projects on all the dead worlds in the galaxy, you had to walk into mine.
Corilyn sank to her knees, sobbing helplessly.
Hey, girl,
Inigo said sympathetically. He knelt down beside her and flipped the outer seals on her helmet.
Where have you been, you bastard?
She screamed. Her fist smacked into his chest.
Why did you leave me? Why did you leave us?
He wiped some of the tears from her cheeks, then leaned forward and kissed her. Corilyn almost fought against it. Then she suddenly was wrapping her arms around him, kissing furiously. The fabric of their suits made scratching noises as they rubbed together. Aaron waited a diplomatic minute, then unsealed his own helmet. The air was bitingly cold and held the strangest smell of rancid mint. His breath emerged in grey streamers.
You're a hard man to find.
Inigo and Corilyn broke apart.
Don't listen to him, Corilyn said urgently. Whatever he wants, refuse. He's insane. He's killed hundreds of people to find you.
Slight exaggeration, Aaron said. No more than 20, surely.
Inigo's steel gray eyes narrowed. I can sense what you are. Who do you represent?
Ah.
Aaron gave a weak smile. I'm not sure. But we're about to find out. He could feel the knowledge stirring in his mind again. He was about to know what to do next. I won't go back, Inigo said simply.
What happened?
Corilin pleaded. Aaron's U-Shadow reported that a call was coming in from Director Ansan Purila. It had been transferred across the hundreds of desolate kilometers from Kajani by the small sturdy beacons to enter the camp, where it finally had trickled down into the excavation through a single strand of fiber optic cable. Yes, Director, Aaron said. Inigo and Corilin gave each other a puzzled glance, then looked at Aaron.
Do you have some colleagues following you?
Ansan Purila asked. No.
Well, there's a ship coming through the atmosphere above us, and it won't respond to any of our signals.
Aaron felt his blood chill. His combat routines came online, as he instinctively shielded himself with the strongest force field his bionics could produce. Get out.
What?
Get out of the base. Everyone out.
Now!
I think you'd better explain exactly what is going on.
Shit!
His U-Shadow used the tenuous link to the base to establish a tiny channel to the artful Dodger smart core.
Tell them!
He yelled at Corilin. She flinched.
Director, please leave. We haven't been honest with you.
She turned to Inigo.
Please,
she hissed. He gave a reluctant sigh.
Anson, this is Earl. Do as Aaron says. Get as many as you can into the starship. Everyone else will have to use the ground cruisers.
But...
The artful Dodger smart core scanned the sky above Kajani. Its sweep was hampered considerably by the protective force field over the base, but it showed Aaron a small mass 30 kilometers high, holding its position above the thick outer cloud blanket.
Come and get us, he told the smart core. Fast.
His exovision showed him the starship powering up. Flight systems took barely a second to come online. Its force field hardened. Directly overhead, an enormously powerful gamma-ray laser struck the base's force field. A scarlet corona flared around the puncture point, and the beam sliced into the generator building. Complete force field failure was an emergency situation that had been incorporated into the base's design. Secondary force fields snapped on over the cottages and science blocks, almost in time to protect them from the first awesome pressure surge. Several sheets of ice crystals hammered against the walls, drilling holes in the grass. Staff members who were caught outside screamed and flung themselves down as the impacts battered them. It was over in seconds as the re-trapped air stilled. When they looked up, they could see the parkland being scoured of grass and bushes by the victorious wind. Their starship had been cut in two by the gamma laser strike. Uneven sections lay twisted on the pad as the cold storm buffeted it about. Beside it, the artful Dodger rose into the maelstrom of radioactive destruction that cascaded across the base the instant the main force field vanished. Sensors showed it a pinprick of dazzling white light searing its way downward, accelerating at 50 Gs. The ship's smart core blasted away at the weapon with neutron lasers and quantum distortion pulses. Nothing happened. The smart core started to change course, but it wasn't fast enough. The light point struck the artful Dodger amidships, unaffected by the force field. Enormous tidal forces tore at the ship's structure, destroying its integrity. Even spars reinforced by bonding fields were ripped out of alignment. Ordinary components were mangled beyond recognition. The entire hull buckled and imploded to a third of its original size. Then the Hawking M-Sync punched through the other side of the ship and streaked onward into the ground. Its intense spark of light vanished. The surrounding ground heaved as if Kajani had been hit by a massive earthquake, annihilating the remaining buildings and structures. All the secondary force fields died, leaving the collapsing cottages and science blocks exposed to the planet's malignant atmosphere. The wreckage of the artful Dodger tumbled out of the hurricane to smash into the ruins of the base. Aaron's contact with the starship was lost as soon as the Hawking M-Sync had penetrated the hull, when every microcircuit and cube was physically distorted and ruptured. A couple of Kajani sensors had caught the last moments of the star that had bolted out of the churning, naked sky. Its speed was such that human eyes registered it as a single line of light,
like a perfectly straight lightning bolt. Radiation monitor records showed a swift peak that went off the scale.
"What the hell just happened?" Corilin demanded.
Aaron was too stunned to reply immediately. His U-shadow confirmed that the beacon relay now ended 2 kilometers short of the base's perimeter.
"They fired on the base," Inigo said quietly.
"Lady, they were completely unarmed."
He glared at Aaron. "Was that one of the factions?"
"Could be. It might even have been the cleric conservator making sure of his tenure.
There's a place in the depths of Honius reserved for your kind. I hope you reach it quickly."
"Where?" Aaron said. Inigo and Corilin gave him an identical snort of disgust.
"We'd better get back up to the shelter," Inigo said. "I expect they'll want to get to Kajani right away. We are one of the closest camps."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.